The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
Here you go, thanks. Next, please.
Can I grab one of the apples, please?
You, sir.
And a banana.
I think he was first.
No, you were first. What are you having, sir?
Two apples.
All right.
Don't forget to give me my banana.
Thanks.
Excuse me, sir. I'll just get one of the apples, please.
And a banana.
A banana. Excuse me. Excuse me. Excuse me.
Look, guys, I don't want any trouble here, all right?
I'm sorry?
Where are you from?
New Zealand.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Why don't you get lost? I don't serve your kind here.
I'd just like to buy an apple, please.
And a banana, please.
That one, thanks.
That apple isn't for sale. Neela, can you go boil us some disinfectant? Thank you. I don't want our customers complaining that our fruit tastes like New Zealanders.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
And the dog show takes a break next week.
That was a great episode of the dog show.
I think I was so rude to me.
What guy?
The guy at the fruit shop.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's unbelievable. Just insulted me.
He was all right.
No, he was racist. Now, the guy told us to leave, said he wouldn't serve our kind.
Yeah.
It's racist and a little bit rude.
Yeah. Well, who knows what he could have meant.
Channel 1.
Welcome, everyone. It is Wednesday, October 15th, 2025. I'm Bob Metz, and this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right-wing. It's Just Right.
To black and white, under the bedclothes, everything will be all right.
The West has become so mired in identity politics that it has become a parody of itself. In fact, it's turning into a multicultural monoculture of irrationality and irrelevancy surrounding collectivized anti-concepts. There's a mouthful for you. And of course, the most prevalent being the left's consistent trumpeting of race and racism. And it's understandable why. Because of course, in fascist times, like the ones we're living in now, the greatest symbol of identity politics is the charge of racism, a word that has all but lost its meaning when directed at the right by the left, to the point where the very label right itself has been made interchangeable with the word racist. And because the left has trumpeted those labels so loudly and for so long that it has not only lost its meaning, it has become increasingly dismissed by most not on the left. And perhaps that is a danger. Why do I suggest that? Because racism does exist, and to simply dismiss each and every accusation of such is to disguise and hide racism's actual presence and its role in Western culture. And then we fail to eliminate it. But before we can do anything meaningful and effective about racism, we must first know how to identify racism when we see or experience it, which is the very first thing that we'll do right after our reminder that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org. Hear us on WBCQ and on Channel 292 Shortwave. Follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible. Ayn Rand defined racism thusly, quote, "Racism is the lowest, most crudely primitive form of collectivism. It is the notion of ascribing moral, social, or political significance to a man's genetic lineage, the notion that a man's intellectual and characterological traits are produced and transmitted by his internal body chemistry, which means, in practice, that a man is to be judged not by his own character and actions, but by the characters and actions of a collective of ancestors. Like every form of collectivism, racism is a quest for the unearned, and, above all, a quest for an automatic self-esteem. Today, racism is regarded as a crime if practiced by the majority, but as an inalienable right if practiced by a minority, end quote. And I don't think you'll find a better definition of racism anywhere, and we've seen it clearly demonstrated in today's political zeitgeist. Based on that definition, it's clear that I live in an explicitly racist country, and it's called Canada. And it must be understood from the outset that racism is exclusively a symptom of the left, since the very notion of racism is based on the collective and on collective identity. And this is perfectly consistent with the leftist political identity of Canada. And we will be getting into some of the particulars of Canada's real racism a little later in the show. But before doing so, some evidence of racism from the country to Canada's south, the United States of America. Politically, history demonstrates that it was predominantly the leftist Democratic Party that pushed racial policies. It was the party of slavery and the Ku Klux Klan, and the party that even supported Hitler during the years leading up to World War II, and on goes a history of a party obsessed with race and class. Worse, the political obsession has now become part of the social fabric, where racist acts are, to put it in the words of Ayn Rand, an inalienable right if practiced by a minority. The recent murder of Irina Zarutska on September 7th was certainly another milestone marker pointing to America's tolerance for violence, when practiced by a minority, and of its indifference to the victims of violence if they are white. But it's not my intention to review a list of outrageous demonstrations of racism being regarded as a crime if practiced by a majority and as an inalienable right if practiced by a minority. Our objective today is to discover what we can do about it and how it must be done, particularly with regard to creating an environment where racial tensions are eliminated or at least minimized to a negligible level. And to kick off that conversation and for further insights during the course of today's show, here is Dad Saves America's John Popola from his own October 10 podcast addressing some disturbing trends toward racial identity politics in his America, along with some historical background of how these trends were all but eliminated during the years immediately preceding the election of President Barack Obama.
Hey there, friends, fans, and foes of Dad Saves America. John Popola here. I came across a couple things this week that frankly have scrambled my brain a little bit, and that I think are worth diving into, because in so many ways, I feel like right now, I have a certain sense of existential dread. And it's partly because it does feel like we are in a French Revolution type of moment.
A shocking number of young Trump voters support socialist policies, a Democrat socialist president in 2028, and even UN supervision of America, according to a new poll from Rasmussen Reports and Justin Haskins. The stuff in here is incredible. 76% of young voters agree that major industries like healthcare, energy, and big tech should be nationalized to give more control and equity to the people, including a strong majority of young Republicans, over 70%. 53% would like to see a Democratic socialist candidate win the 2028 presidential election, including a huge amount, 35% of those who said they voted for Trump in 2024. 55% said they would support a law that would confiscate Americans' excess wealth.
It's interesting what constitutes excess. When does your wealth become excess, and who determines that? There is a massive gap taking place between our elites of all sorts and our young people and working class people and normal people. I'm both horrified by this and I also understand it. For the past, let's say, 15 years in particular, our sons, boys like my son, have been getting told crazy stuff. They've entered middle school in an era of both Me Too and sort of woke identity politics and been told that this is not their time. Our boys are getting bombarded by this every which way, but especially in school. But not just school, also in the workplace, also in the broader culture. Now, there's been a shift, but as this Rasmussen report points out, that shift might be more temporary than we would like for those of us that are happy that some of this woke reign of terror has seemingly come to at least a temporary end. One of the outcomes of this assault on our boys is the rise of voices and the mainstreaming of voices that frankly adopt the identity war mindset. And one of them is Nick Fuentes. Now, if you haven't heard of Nick Fuentes, because, you know, my audience looks a little like me, sort of older dads, he's a young guy who is a rising voice on the right, and he's starting to be replatformed now that the censorship industrial complex has ebbed a little bit. And he was just this week, just a couple days ago, on Dave Smith's podcast, and the thing already has a million views. It was instantly a gigantic hit. Nick is a voice of these young men.
We're not going to live in a white ethno state. Mm-hmm. We can't go back to 1965 and undo the Immigration Act. And this is going to be a multiracial society of some sort. And we ought to think about, like, okay, how do we move forward in a way that's conducive to peace and prosperity, which is kind of what we all on some level want?
Yeah, it's a difficult question, because I guess it comes down to multiracialism itself, because we do live in different America. There was, I'm told, the consensus in the 90s and the early noughts where people describe race relations as generally good.
There's a bunch of points here. The one is a question. Can we have a multicultural society and have it work? And we have told ourselves, certainly our elite institutions have been telling us, that this is the nature of America. And I broadly actually agree with that, that we have been a multicultural society for a pretty long time. We are maybe the only truly successful multiracial, multicultural society. The only other one I can think of in this hemisphere, in the new world, so to speak, is Brazil. And Brazil is a basket case. So we're it. If it's going to work, it's going to work here. It might only work here. But what's he talking about with the 90s? Well, he's echoing something that I say here all the time, which is the late 90s was indeed the peak of Western civilization. And when it comes to race relations, the late 90s and the early 2000s really were a peak. This is the Gallup poll on race relations that Nick is talking about and that I have referenced on a couple of occasions. And it asks the question, would you say relations between white and black people are very good, somewhat bad, or very bad? And this graph here is of those who said it was either good or very good. And as you can see, entering the 21st century, black and white people were pretty close to each other, and a supermajority said good or very good. And then it takes this horrible turn, starting in 2013. But one of the other things, as I've been going back to the 90s, is that there was stuff going on in the 90s that echoes a lot of recent times.
There are 3,000 National Guardsmen on duty in the city of Los Angeles. I will use whatever force is necessary to restore order.
In April of 1992, President George H.W. Bush federalized the California National Guard to help local law enforcement regain control in Los Angeles during the L.A. riots. The unrest stemmed from the police beating of Rodney King, which was caught on camera. The officers involved were acquitted, and there were fires, looting, and destruction throughout the city.
Why are we the victims? My parents are good Christians. We've been through so much, and to go through this, everything, 22 years down the drain.
Many Koreans who yesterday were the shopkeepers of South Central Los Angeles today have lost the businesses they took years to create.
What can I say? I don't have any word to say. This looks a comeback, John.
George Huang woke this morning to find his mini mall burnt to the ground. A loss of $1.5 million and a lifetime of dreams and effort. 41 Korean businesses in South Central have been torched, dozens looted. In this overwhelmingly black and Hispanic area, Koreans own many of the small businesses. They're insular, they employ their own, they keep to themselves. Blacks say that's the problem.
I'm not surprised that the Koreans got targeted because their prices are high, their attitude is wrong. And they just don't seem to have any respect for the black community.
Can't we all just get along isn't new. Despite the Rodney King beating, despite the tensions between black communities and the police, the fact of the matter is, this was actually the high watermark at this moment for crime in the United States. And what came next drove crime down to all-time lows, to the point where when I moved to New York City in 1999, the place is clean, the place is super safe. It's actually like the safest big city in the country. And there's a Republican mayor, Rudy Giuliani, who's broadly liked. It's like another reality looking back 25 years ago.
I'm a black man. There's no justice for me here in America. I should be at the front of the line.
Yeah, well, I'm gay and subject to ridicule and discrimination wherever I go.
Women are oppressed throughout the world. Give it a rest.
Thank you.
We went through a mini version of all of this stuff 25 years ago and came out the other end feeling pretty good about America, feeling like the future had possibilities. There wasn't a lot of desire to burn the country to the ground. Not on the left, not on the right, only on the whack job left. But there was indeed a whack job left, the critical theory left, the people that were driving the early version of this political correctness, this radical intersectionalism that tells our young boys, especially our young white boys, that they're the source of all of our problems and radicalizes them. And you can see a future president celebrating this radicalism firsthand in 1990.
And I remember that the black law students had organized an orientation for the first year students. And one of the persons who spoke at that orientation was Professor Bell. And I remember him sauntering up to the front and not giving us a lecture, but engaging us in a conversation and speaking the truth and telling us that he had to learn at this place that I've carried with me ever since. Open up your hearts and your minds to the words of Professor Derrick Bell.
Open up your hearts and your minds to Derrick Bell. Who is Derrick Bell? Well, this was the man behind critical race theory. Derrick Bell and others, Kimberly Crenshaw and others, they were the ones that really laid the foundation for the kind of supercharged identity politics that still permeates our campuses to this literal very day and has radicalized our sons and pushed them into the hands of a lot of different voices that wouldn't be my favorite choice, like Nick Fuentes, people who are embracing identity politics themselves, white identity politics. And so that might help explain how and why, starting around 2013, race relations began to collapse under President Barack Obama. The collapse of race relations was precipitous, and it was under President Obama. And it wasn't because President Obama was black, because don't forget, he got reelected quite handily. It was because he was a critical theory guy fundamentally. The era of Black Lives Matter, the radicalization that really found its peak in the 2020 through 2024 time period under President Obama's vice president, come president, Joe Biden. Horrible, horrible stuff. Total collapse. In 2013, black adults, 66% said they thought race relations in this country were good to very good. By 2021, they were down to 33%, cut in half, only a third, from two-thirds to one-third. This was a radical destruction of our multicultural society. This was something that was the backdrop for all of this identity psychopathy. And one of the most ironic things is I hadn't actually looked at this in a little bit. It looks like they have recently updated the data that shows this kind of amazing bounce back this year, 2025. Still not to the peaks, still not all the way back, but it's interesting that President Trump 2.0 is presiding over a rebound in perceived race relations between blacks and whites, among both white people and black people.
While that's good news, the fact that we're even thinking in terms of black and white, not on moral terms, but in terms of skin color, is in and of itself a cultural tragedy. If I have one major criticism of John Popola's historical account of identity politics in America, it concerns the confusion of the terms multiculturalism with multiracial or multiethnic. But that's a distinction we'll be making clear in the last quarter of today's show. And as to his question, can we have a multicultural society and make it work? No. But that too will be explained along with what will work in the final quarter of the show.
How's it going?
Pretty bad. We're in the middle of a race war, Murray.
What's that?
Bad, we're in the middle of a race war.
Have you guys written any songs?
No, I've been too busy with the race war.
Race war. It's very time-consuming.
Well, that's one way to look at it. And sadly, there might be more truth to that statement than we would care to admit. And of course, the observation that black-white relations were good until 2013 when Obama became president was certainly consistent with Obama's socialist agenda for America, particularly through establishing identity politics. In fact, we featured the Obama bombshell back on our July 30 show, following the Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard's bombshell report regarding President Barack Obama's traitorous actions against the United States of America. And then there's this disturbing public poll that suggests a majority of young Americans would support a law that would confiscate excess wealth. Well, if that's the case, then every penny so confiscated, or stolen to be more precise, would itself become excess wealth. And who's going to expropriate that? And from whom? If the term excess wealth is to have any meaning at all, it would only apply to those people who got that wealth without having to earn it, say, by stealing it from the people who did earn it. To a person who earns the wealth through free, voluntary exchange, there is no such thing as excess wealth. And in that light, I really had to sympathize with some of the Korean voices cited in the previous LA riots, where one of them lamented the loss of 22 years down the drain. And I was completely disgusted by the black rioter who justified the attacks on the Korean community by saying, quote, "I'm not surprised that their stores were targeted, their prices are high, their attitude is wrong, and they just don't have no respect for the black community," end quote. Well, that's because their attitude is that of a productive person, not of a consumptive parasite. And these are cultural distinctions, not racial ones. Up next, more from John Popola of Dad Saves America on this side of the bumper, but on the return side, our attention will briefly shift to Canada's dystopian identity politics as Dan Dix of Press for Truth draws our attention to a racial pricing scheme where whites are charged twice the price for a service than non-whites. Seriously.
I'm trying to grapple with these different voices in this movement, especially on the right, which is kind of where I broadly sit. And I think Nick's rise means something, and we have to take it seriously. How do we chart a course that can solve for this problem of living together in a multicultural, multiracial society, something that humans don't have a great track record on? The regime that we are currently under is still fundamentally the one that was kicked off by Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society.
The Great Society rests on abundance and liberty for all. It demands an end to poverty and racial injustice, to which we're totally committed in our time. So will you join in the battle? We have the power to shape the civilization that we want.
We have the power to shape the civilization that we want. This was the civil rights moment. This was the birth of the Civil Rights Act, which did several things that were necessary and important at the time. The most important of which was disbanding the Jim Crow laws, a function of state and local laws. But this idea of states' rights, that we are all different states with different legal structures that have their own sovereignty, and that, you know, the 10th Amendment says that anything not explicitly enumerated for the federal government should be left to the states. That's federalism, states' rights. That was a dirty word because the states were imposing Jim Crow laws, segregation, and structural, formal, legal racism. And it was actually the federal government that came to the rescue of that. But the other pieces of the puzzle have outlived their usefulness. Namely, the construction of legal privileges for not just black people, but for women and for an increasing list of protected classes. This has created our modern problems in a very real sense, legally. Specifically, I think it is time to abolish all of this. That would require the dismantling of a lot of what is currently US labor law and the structures of the Affirmative Action and Civil Rights Act that specifically discriminate in favor of certain groups and against disfavored groups, which has increasingly only meant white men. This is the engine of grievance of our time today. The structure of affirmative action, of equity, of trying to use the government to ensure equal outcomes, not just equal treatment. This was opposed by thinkers like Thomas Sowell, going back to the 1980s, going back to the early days of this movement. And you can see him battle Frances Fox Piven, whose name is important, and I will come back to who she is exactly in a minute, but just hear out this exchange.
People are born into this world in a given sector of a society, and many, many of them are born at the bottom of the society. The argument for about equality of results was an argument that was linked to equality of opportunity. People recognized that unless there was a degree of equality in a degree of enough food, enough security, access to education. Unless these things were available to all children, then equality of opportunity was merely a mockery. That's why equality of results became an issue, and it became an issue for black people in the United States, and they expressed their concern, no, whatever the opinion.
You expressed it, damn it, look. They did not.
They expressed their will by their extraordinary participation in a protest movement that began in the late 1950s and didn't end until
I have never.
Intellectuals were not in that protest movement.
You want me to answer, or you want to keep going? You want me to answer?
I finished.
Yes. Good. Black people have never supported, for example, affirmative action, POTUS, anything of that sort. Wherever polls have been taken of black opinion on such matters of should people be paid equally or should there be this or that, black people have never taken a position that you describe. So it is not a question of what black people chose to do. It's what you choose to put in the mouths of black people. It is what you choose to project. A very small handful of intellectuals have generated an enormous amount of noise. When I look at opinion polls, particularly if I look at opinion polls of blacks in the United States, most blacks in the United States do not take any strong position in favor of equality of results. In fact, most of the polls that I've seen of blacks put them, if you want to use this expression, very well to the right of most intellectuals on most of these social issues. It is not the people who are stirring, it is a handful of intellectuals. The question is not absolute equality, it's a question of what concept of equality you're aiming at, whether you're getting it absolutely or to one degree or the other. Are you aiming at a concept of equality of opportunity at the outset, or are you aiming at a concept of equality of results? I would go beyond the question of equality and put it more generally, that any process to ascribe any status to any group of people, equality, inferiority, superiority, must necessarily reduce freedom, because whatever the government wishes to ascribe to any group, whatever place, to use the phrase that was very common in the South, that blacks should have their place, whatever place the government is going to assign to people, that place will not coincide. Wait, that place will not coincide either with what all those people are doing or with how others perceive all those people, because there's too much diversity among human beings. To maintain any system of ascribed status from the top is going to mean reducing people's freedom across the spectrum.
The most important public intellectual of our times, from my perspective, Thomas Sowell. Laying waste to the ideology of affirmative action and of unequal treatment by the law. His opponent there, the high-minded social signaling intellectual professor, was none other than Frances Fox Pivens, of the rightfully maligned, by some at least, by me, Cloward-Piven strategy. Let me just read. This is from Wikipedia. Or Wokipedia, depending on how you look at it these days. The Cloward-Piven strategy is a political strategy outlined in 1966 by American sociologists and political activists Richard Cloward and Frances Fox Piven. The strategy aims to utilize militant anti-poverty groups to facilitate a political crisis by overloading the welfare system via an increase in welfare claims, forcing the creation of a system of guaranteed minimum income and redistributing income through the federal government.
This is Dan Dix here reporting for Press for Truth. The word racist has completely lost all meaning ever since the left flings it at anybody who disagrees with them. But in a shocking turn of events, they are bringing its true meaning back to life by becoming blatantly racist themselves. A woke Canadian fitness studio has just recently proudly advertised race-based pricing. They are literally charging white clients twice as much as non-whites. R Studios is a wellness gym based in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and they recently openly promoted a $30 drop-in rate for white visitors while offering a heavily discounted $15 rate exclusively for BIPOC, which stands for Black, Indigenous, and People of Color customers. This policy blatantly violates Canada's anti-discrimination laws because it literally amounts to race-based economic segregation. Could you guys imagine what the response would be if the races were reversed? The Canadian BLM movement would make the US's George Floyd riots look like a lovely walk in the park. The company has since released a statement on social media. In a fitness industry that has long been predominantly white, and often inaccessible, we have taken pride in being leaders who actively promote diversity through our hiring practices in studio equity and inclusion training and the creation of our IDEA, Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Accessibility Committee, with ongoing efforts to ensure all individuals feel seen and represented within our walls. Recently, our organization has received feedback and criticism surrounding one of those efforts, a discounted membership created by our BIPOC team and IDEA committee to help foster diversity and inclusion. Historically, we have offered a range of accessible pricing and programs, and while this initiative was built from a place of compassion and community, we understand that it has been interpreted by some as exclusive. So in other words, we're not sorry for what we did. We're just sorry that you had an incorrect interpretation. If I came across anything like this in my area, I would just identify as black and see how they handle that one. In all seriousness though, this whole thing is stemming from the myth that is white privilege. White privilege is the imaginary belief that all your problems in life are not your fault, nor are they curable by having you as an individual take responsibility for your own life. But instead, white privilege encourages its proponents to blame white people for all of their problems, as well as any social, political, or cultural issues that Western society might be having. When in reality, if there was any systemic racism in Canada or the US, there would be clear evidence of it. Like, oh, you know, actual laws that would prohibit black or indigenous people from participating in politics or business or freedoms that white people have. So white privilege is just a racist concept that promotes neglecting your own responsibility for your own beliefs and actions in the world. It's a racist concept that instead puts all of the blame for all the ills in the world and all of your personal problems on a single racial group. This is literally what the Nazis did with the Jews. So the important takeaway here is that this is not an issue of black versus white. It's not even race related. The division in society comes from the difference between people who produce wealth in exchange with their fellow man on a mutual basis versus the people who just take, that is, steal, rob, and tax. Because there are only two classes in life, ladies and gentlemen, tax producers and tax eaters. So it's not a white privilege thing. It's a state power versus social power thing. We both see that something is wrong in this world, and we both want to see systems of oppression eliminated. It's just that I correctly identify the problem as beginning with the central bank. And in a cultural movement that has moved away from Jesus Christ and the foundational values of the West. If we can all recognize that together and unify against our common enemy, the central banksters, then I think everyone would be much better off in the long run.
You're listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. So what Dan Dix would have us believe is that by uniting against bankers and moving closer to Jesus Christ, the quote-unquote problem behind race-based prices charging whites twice the price of non-whites would be solved. Now, to me, that's a non sequitur. And you know, that's Dan's solution to a myriad of political and economic issues, and is again another example of what I've been calling the injection of religious righteousness into an issue that can easily be resolved without having to call upon religious faith. But I was somewhat stunned by his assertion that if there was any systemic racism in Canada or the U.S., there would be clear evidence of it, like actual laws that would prohibit black or indigenous people from participating in politics or business or freedoms that white people have. Well, who is he kidding? It's just that right now, those systemic racist laws prohibit white people from participating in politics or business or freedoms that non-white people have. Consider how the officially registered New Democratic Party of Canada is conducting its leadership debate to replace its last racist leader, Jagmeet Singh. On September 3rd, Rebel Media reported that, quote, of the required 500 member signatures, at least 50 need to be from each of five Canadian regions, and 100 from equity-seeking groups, meaning racialized, indigenous, LGBTQ+, and disabled groups, end quote. And if that wasn't bad enough, the party also outrageously insists, quote, that at least half of any candidate's 500 required signatures come from party members who identify as anything but a cis man, end quote. What a friggin' train wreck of identity politics the very undemocratic New Democratic Party is. Wow. And has Dan Dix ever heard of official bilingualism and the ethnic racist treatment that the province of Quebec often inflicts on its English-speaking minorities? Or about the fines and penalties levied on businesses who fail to put French first on bilingual signs, etc.? Has he heard of Canada's Indigenous reserves, where Indigenous people are denied the right to own private property and even often lack basics like clean running water and other basic utilities? Meanwhile, on the other side of the Indigenous coin, when it comes to paying federal income tax, I note on Canada's federal income tax returns that those who are entitled to be registered under the Indian Act do not have to pay income tax on Canada Pension Plan or Quebec Pension Plan benefits, employment insurance benefits, and a whole range of various incomes, including rental income from a property situated on a reserve, etc. And of course, these are exemptions that those who are not entitled to be registered under the Indian Act do not equally qualify for and do have to pay taxes on. And what about the questions on Canada's census forms, which are obsessed with categorizing and identifying each individual's racial, language, and ethnic background? And by the way, where transgender identities are accepted. If you're wondering where all of these ridiculous and immoral racist policies and practices originate, like demanding signatures from equity-seeking groups, which include racialized, indigenous, and LGBTQ+ groups, you have no further to look than to the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Quite possibly, this is where many get the impression that racial discrimination is illegal in Canada, particularly when they cite the Equality Rights Section 15(1), which reads, quote, every individual is equal before and under the law and has the right to equal protection and equal benefit of the law without discrimination and, in particular, without discrimination based on race, national or ethnic origin, color, religion, sex, age, or mental or physical disability, end quote. However, subsection 2 of that same equality rights section reads, quote, subsection 1 does not preclude any law, notice it says any law, program or activity that has as its object the amelioration of conditions of disadvantaged individuals or groups, including those that are disadvantaged because of race, national or ethnic origin, color, religion, sex, age, or mental or physical disability, end quote. Practically cancels out subsection 1. And to make the point even more pronounced, under the general section, section 27, it reads, quote, this charter shall be interpreted in a manner consistent with the preservation and enhancement of the multicultural heritage of Canadians, end quote. Thank you, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, who signed this document in 1981. So again, I don't see how Dan Dick's solution of uniting against central bankers and moving closer to Jesus Christ will possibly ameliorate these flaws in Canada's Charter of Wrongs and Tyranny. And consider that word, ameliorate. The dictionary defines it as, quote, to make or become better, improve, end quote. It has little or nothing to do with preventing starvation or homelessness, since those groups being ameliorated are not defined in these terms, but are defined in terms of race, national or ethnic origin, color, religion, sex, etc. And what legitimate business is it of any government to, quote-unquote, enhance multiculturalism? In the case of Canada's government, it's not about enhancing or even acknowledging anything that could be called Canadian culture. Now, I haven't addressed any of John Popola's commentary immediately preceding what we heard from Dan Dix, because he'll be getting the last word in on the grand solution to this racist problem on the return side of our next bumper, and that's where it will all come together into a cohesive narrative that I will address. But first, here's another humorous interpretation of identity politics as provided by the New Zealand musical comedy duo of Brett McKenzie and Jermaine Clement in the HBO television series Flight of the Conchords.
Why don't you get an apple from someone who doesn't hate our country, Brett?
Thanks so much.
Excuse me, I'd like to buy this apple, please.
New Zealander, stop touching my fruit. It's not allowed.
What's wrong with New Zealanders?
Hey, Neela! Can we bleach this one up? It's been infected.
I want to buy that. I'll pay for it.
No, not this apple, New Zealandy. You can buy apples from over there, my special New Zealand section. It's $10 a piece.
There's a dog in the New Zealand section.
Well, it's for dogs from America and people from New Zealand.
Yeah, you're being racist.
How dare you call me a racist?
He doesn't mean racist. He means xenophobic.
Oh. You're being xenophobic.
You know what? Just get lost, New Zealanders.
I'm not going anywhere till I get a red delicious and a banana.
You want a brown delicious to the face?
No.
You want to make trouble for me, huh?
I don't. Brett was sort of driving the situation.
We're not going anywhere till we get an apple.
I'm gonna count to 10.
Are you counting in your head?
Yeah.
What are you up to?
7.
I think I'm gonna write him a letter, tell him how I feel.
Yeah.
You know what you could do? Inject strychnine into a piece of his fruit. Then when a customer dies, the CIA will trace it back to the vendor, and he's going straight to the big house. Alcatraz.
Yeah, I don't really want to kill anyone though, Dave.
Why not? Haven't you seen Escape from Alcatraz? It wasn't easy, bro. Forget about it.
What about... Oh, no, never mind.
What?
What was
no,
it?
No, it wouldn't work. Wouldn't work.
No, say it.
Well, sometimes what I do is I think mean thoughts about the person.
How do they know?
They don't know. I know. That's why I didn't suggest it.
So what you guys need is something a little more subtle than framing him for murder, which I actually think is still a great idea, but more obvious than thinking mean thoughts about him. Why don't you just insult him back?
Hey, New Zealander!
He's out there.
New Zealanders are all unhygienic.
That's a stereotype.
Hey, what are you guys doing? You bungee jumping up there?
No.
No.
No, we're not.
Hey, New Zealanders all have tartar on their teeth.
Say a comeback to him.
He's shouting stereotypes, racist stereotypes at us.
Let him have it, man.
Banana balls.
You look like a something, like a banana balls.
New Zealanders all mumble. I can't understand you.
What?
He turned it around back on us.
Flip him the bird.
What?
Flip him the bird.
Hey, cool it, man. What are you doing? Hey, Neela, cover your eyes. How dare you come here and give me those offensive hand gestures in my fruit stand?
It was either this or getting you sent into Alcatraz.
How dare you treat us like secondhand citizens?
It doesn't matter what country someone's from or what they look like or the color of their skin. It doesn't matter what they smell like or that they spell words slightly differently. Some would say more correctly.
Yeah.
Let me finish. I'm a person. Brett's a person.
Yeah.
You're a person. That person over there is a person. Well, and each person deserves to be treated like a person.
It's a great speech. Too bad New Zealanders are a bunch of cocky a-holes descended from criminals and retarded monkeys.
Are you thinking of Australians?
Yeah, that's Australians.
That's Australians.
No, 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 New Zealanders. They throw another shrimp on the barbie, ride around in your kangaroos all day.
No,
it's Australians.
You're thinking of Australians, that's not us.
I've totally confused you with Australians. I feel terrible. Your accents, they're just kind of similar.
Our accents are completely different. They're like, where's the car? And we're like, where's the car?
You know what? Hey, have some of my fruit, please. I feel terrible. Do you want that Red Delicious still?
Oh, I would love that Red Delicious, okay. Yeah.
This Red Delicious is on me. You still want that banana?
Thank you. I love that banana.
Yeah.
Oh
my. Here you go.
Oh, that's
hey,
so crazy.
I'm Sinjay.
I'm Jermaine. Good to meet you.
Britt.
Neela, you can uncover your eyes. They're not Australians. They're New Zealanders.
So let's come back to a question raised by Mr. Fuentes.
And so we've undergone this political transformation, and on the other side of it, we do have a much different America. And the question is, now that we really do have like these large groups of different races in the country, can there be a brand new political order that's based on understanding? And it comes down to the question of that in itself. And to me, all these little things that they were talking about 20 years ago or 10 years ago, representation, microaggressions, opportunity, it's really about power. That's ultimately what it comes down to.
This is the crossroads we're at as a country. Nick, and a non-trivial percentage of people that are out there, young people, on the left and the right, see this as entirely a power game to be fought along ideological and specifically identitarian lines. For Nick, it's about putting white people back on top, or at least understanding that race matters in ways that are not consistent with the way our founders understood it. Our founders, even though they owned slaves, had an understanding of an ideal, an American ideal, the fundamental American ideal, articulated by slaveholding Thomas Jefferson. And that was this.
The idea took form. Something new was expressed by men, a new and revolutionary doctrine, the greatest creative force in human relations. All men are created equal. All men are entitled to the blessings of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's the goal we set for ourselves. Defeat meant hanging. Victory meant a world in which Americans rule themselves.
All men are created equal. Now, this is false. All men are not created equal. All people are not created equal. We are a diverse, different creature. We have wildly different capabilities. And those capabilities end up expressing themselves in a modern context with the most unequal outcomes one can possibly imagine. An incredible basketball player can earn a multiple of my income. That is truly astonishing. And that's just the nature of the world we live in. That is the nature of a modern broad society where you have the potential to create value for millions of people with your work, with your effort. So unequal outcomes and inequality of material reality are facts. They are facts. And I think the only way we can ever make progress in this world is by being rooted in reality, in facts. We can't Ayn Rand has this saying, you can ignore reality, but you can't ignore the consequences of ignoring reality. And the entire ideology of critical race theory, of affirmative action, of a legal set of institutions designed to actively discriminate on the basis of your identity, these run counter to the facts. When you treat people special by law, you add costs onto them that they don't even realize you're adding. You undermine their credibility as having earned their way, number one. So you become a diversity hire. That sucks. Nobody wants to be the diversity hire. and we shouldn't force it upon them by law. Number two, when you make it more expensive to hire particular groups, you make it less likely that you will do so. That is a fact. That is a reality. All of the utopian schemes of the left can't escape that reality. And so I think it's time that we return to equal treatment under the law, legal fairness for real, is that we have an equal, impartial referee, and that referee will apply equal rules to all the players, and may the best man or woman win. I want that for this country more than anything else, as a father, as an American. The only way you can have civility and sportsmanship if we are all playing by the same rules. That doesn't even mean equal opportunity. I'm not sure that is a linguistic thing that right-wingers say as opposed to equal outcomes. We want equal opportunity. There's no such thing as equal opportunity. That's never going to be a thing. Not fully. It shouldn't even be talked about that way. I think that that's a mistake. What we need is equal treatment. Equal treatment under the law. And if we had that, this society, kind of like the late 90s, would start to heal. This needs to be expanded beyond just race and identity. We need to have equal treatment under the law for everything. Namely, there should be no companies that get special privileges. In fact, companies should get no privileges at all. There should be no subsidies for particular industries. There should be no corporate welfare. In fact, we should kill that first, to be perfectly honest. But if you take this principle of equality under the law seriously, it would radically restructure our society for the better. And in a time where there is more and more desire for radical change, this is the best one I can possibly offer you to consider. Imagine a world where the government simply can't pick any winners or losers ever, where it can't censor anyone for any reason ever, where it can't play any kinds of favorites ever. I think there'd be a lot more sportsmanship and a lot more civility.
John Popola quite correctly concludes that we must return to equal treatment under the law, an equal impartial referee, equal rules to all the players. And therein lies the way to bring down the entire identity politics tyranny. I cannot count how many times over the many years that this show has been running that I have clearly stated that a free society is a society in which the government is the referee and not a player in the game. Why such a basic, obvious, and fundamental principle should be so ignored by human beings desiring to live peacefully among one another is a question that deserves our utmost attention. And we might laugh at the ridiculous distinctions made between Australians and New Zealanders. You might call it a case of simple, mistaken identity. Identity politics, that is. But that's because the cultural differences between those two nations appear negligible to most people when compared to the cultural differences between Western individualistic cultures and deeply collectivist cultures. And kudos to Popola for recognizing that the statement that all men are created equal is false. People are not created equal, we are all different. But in arriving at his very correct prescription for a free society, Popola really only addressed one half of his question, which he worded thusly. How can we solve the problem of living together in a multiracial, multicultural society? Well, yes, the government acting as a referee will certainly resolve the multiracial tensions in a given society, but not so when it comes to a multicultural society. Culture is not about skin color. It's about the color of your ideas. And the idea of government as referee is a cultural concept, one that most cultures in the world explicitly reject. To attempt to mix or otherwise assimilate cultures based on ideas of the left is to totally reject the fundamentals of a free society. Does anyone really think that Sharia law is compatible with freedom? Or theocracy compatible with freedom? Or group rights compatible with freedom? Or the awarding of status to people based on which group they belong to being compatible with freedom? Earlier on in his previous audio bite, John Popola featured his own audio bite in which we heard Thomas Sowell make a quite remarkable statement, quote, any process that prescribes any status, whether equality, inferiority, or superiority, will mean reducing people's freedom across the spectrum. End quote. Notice that Sowell stresses any status, even a status of equality, which some might find surprising. In this regard, I was immediately reminded of author Isabel Patterson's book, The God of the Machine, in which Chapter 5 was titled The Society of Status and the Society of Contract, a title that already hints at the fundamental distinction between these two modes of civilization. And I was also reminded of some of my own political conflicts in the past with highly socialist groups like the Status of Women Action Groups, which act as a feminist front advocating status for women and not rights for women. The distinctions are critical. Status is a concept of the left. Rights are a concept of the right, something that almost seems self-evident given that both words are virtually the same. Wrote Patterson, quote, "In the society of contract, man is born free and comes into his inheritance with maturity. By this concept, all rights belong to the individual. Society consists of individuals in voluntary association. The rights of any person are limited only by the equal rights of another person. In the society of status, nobody has any rights. The individual is not recognized. A man is defined by his relation to the group and is presumed to exist only by permission. The society of status is privilege and subjection. The logic of status ignores physical fact. The vital functions of a living creature do not wait for permission. The society of status is obliged to restrict production to the energy potential it can accommodate. It does so by collectivism. Group ownership as the norm of property requires the denial of liberty to persons. The resultant poor standard of living ensues famine and plague, for a planned economy cannot even be imagined except under political subjection. A complex economy necessitates the political simplicity of free contract." End quote. Some very interesting points to ponder in this comparative description of what really amounts to left and right, with the left representing status and the right representing contract. But note in particular Patterson's statement, "The society of status is privilege and subjection." Now, how often do we hear the term white privilege coming from the voices of the left? Apparently, this concept is about a lot more than just a racist hate word. It's about the collectivist way of thinking. Everything is about status, and privilege is about status. The idea that individuals can be productive and earn their quote-unquote status in life is alien to the alien left. For them, it's all about oppressor versus oppressed, with them being the oppressors pretending to be the oppressed. And how often have we been hearing that there is a political war being waged against the middle class? This is no mere metaphor or vague association with economic status. Again, as Patterson explains, quote, "The term middle class is grossly inaccurate. What is now called the middle class was not and is not a class. It is a different form of society, a classless society, the free society, the society of contract," end quote. Is it any wonder that the left, the ideologues of status, hate the middle class so much? Because a free society is a society free of their control. So, for those of you who are still free of their grip, consider making a contract to join us again next week, when we will continue our journey in the right direction. And until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, and color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
He goes, "Well, what are you?" I tell him, I go, "Segura is Spanish." And he goes, "That's weird. You look white." I go, "I am white." And he goes, "But you're Spanish?" And I go, "Correct." He goes, "Do you speak Spanish?" I said, "Yes." He goes, "So you're Mexican?" And I go, "No." And he goes, "I don't know what's going on." I said, "What's going on is you failed fucking social studies." And then I see his head drop, like he feels bad. I'm like, "Look, man, you understand there's white people in Mexico. You know that part." And he goes, "No, I don't." I said there's white people there, there's black people there, there's even Asian people there. And if you really want to shit your pants, those Asian people, they speak Spanish too.
You don't expect it, but they're like, dim sum, muy rico, si lo quiero probar, si no lo quiero probar, concha tu madre, nadie te quiere, anda la mierda. They are...